Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey. Or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey. PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show.
Where employees can do the things that humans are designed to do, and that is share information peer-to-peer, run experiments and get feedback, take small risks and not get punished if they fail, disagree with colleagues and leaders if they see an alternative point of view. These things are widely discouraged in a way that sort of standard management approach, in my view, really almost shuts down culture from the get-go.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools, and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process.
Hey, welcome to the show today. We are here getting towards the end of season 17, and our guest today is an anthropologist who is going to help you, or at least was an anthropologist. I think still identifies as an anthropologist. We'll find out in just a minute. But you're going to find out today how to organize and lead in a way that helps people naturally engage, innovate, hold themselves accountable, and way more. So our guest today is Drew Jones, PhD, who's an anthropologist, as I mentioned, former business school professor and practicing management consultant. He's a founding partner of Experient, a workplace culture and strategy consultancy, and over the past 20 years has worked on culture, leadership, and workplace design projects with clients throughout the US, Europe, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America. Drew, I don't see Antarctica on that list.
Haven't been there yet.
You know what? We have the same problem. I am still waiting for that one leadership consultancy in Antarctica. So if you're listening and you're at McMurdo, give us a ring. What, Drew or I, either one of us, we'll take it. Drew's been published widely academic management journals, magazines, has published 3 previous books on design thinking, innovation, co-working, and activity-based working. And his new book, which we're going to be talking about today, is called Open Culture Handbook, 5 Questions to Drive Engagement and Innovation. Drew Jones, welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
Oh, we appreciate you being here to share some of your wisdom and insights with us. So, you know, before we get into the book and get into to your experience and this open culture framework, I'd like you to take us back to your earliest memory of yourself as a leader, as far back as you want to go. Maybe the first time as you think back, oh, yeah, that was leadership. What comes up for you?
Wow, that's a great opening question. First, I wanted to make one sort of logistical sort of correction, which I realize I did not mention to you. Our company, Experient, has rebranded, and we have a new name, and I'll mention that later. So I don't want anybody to go there and thinking that they'll find all of these ideas. And towards the end, I can provide a current URL and corporate name. Well, you know, that's a great question. I think I grew up as a tennis brat and played tennis for many years as a kid and college scholarship and all that. But when I was a kid, I was really driven and trained a lot. And then at some point along the way, I started to teach lessons to other younger kids. And I believe that that was probably the first moment where I thought, you know, gosh, I'm gotten this down pretty well. And I went to this place where there were courts and then there were these kids that were asking for lessons and the tennis pros were full. They didn't have any time in their schedule. So I said, well, you know, I can teach them. And so I got my folks to buy me a basket of balls and scheduled the courts and started to teach younger kids tennis lessons. And it was a moment where it's like, okay, you have to liaise with the parents and get it scheduled and have a little calendar book and organize and get them out there. And these little toddlers could barely hold a racket. And so lining them up, and it was not really a leadership moment, like a big time thing, but I was probably 12, you know, couldn't drive or anything, had my folks take me there. So that would probably be the first one. And it was around sports. And so, which was a big part of my life growing up. So I'd say that's probably the first one that I can remember.
Fantastic. That teaching, that coaching element of leadership has certainly been a through line for you. You've been a professor doing the culture and strategy consultancy work now. And so that's definitely been a through line. I love hearing these stories about, as we look back, where yeah. our earliest memories are.
Great question. I've done a lot of these talks, and that's the first time I've been asked that. I appreciate that. I'll think about it now.
I might have one or two more of those that you haven't been
okay.
asked. We'll see how it goes.
Let's do that.
All right. Well, let's get into this open culture handbook. Five questions to drive engagement and innovation. Our guest today, Drew Jones, PhD. And so, Drew, first, I mentioned the anthropology thing, and specifically, if I'm not mistaken, evolutionary anthropology. Is that so? For those of us for whom it has been a minute, and we might get our archaeology, anthropology, and who knows what other ologies mixed up. Help us with what is it? What is this perspective that you're bringing to this conversation about business culture?
Yeah, well, really, I mean, I'm a cultural anthropologist by training. And generally, when people talk about evolutionary anthropology, they're talking about the work of archaeologists and biological anthropologists who study primate evolution and the whole emergence of hominins from our primate ancestors and that sort of thing. But more recently, both evolutionary psychologists, who I sort of don't align myself with because there's a lot of political reasons behind that, but evolutionary anthropologists really focus in on sort of elemental aspects of the human experience that emerged early in human evolution, like culture, and that's my focus, that are still with us today and are still central parts of the human experience. And so really it's the focus in on not human nature in the general sense, that's a lot where evolutionary psychology, I think, goes sideways, but our innate cultural nature, that we're cultural beings. And that's where, as Nigel Nicholson, a former professor at London Business School, say, you know, we're a communitarian species bound together by culture. And so the reason for me that this is a powerful point of view is that through, whether it was early infatuation with Margaret Mead or Ruth Benedict or these popular anthropologists back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that generally speaking, this is really one of the motivations behind writing the book, is I wanted to bring some science to corporate discussion of culture, because culture is anything and everything. It's, in my view, it's devolved into a wish list of values, integrity, culture, or integrity, honesty, innovation. Of course, innovation is something we will all aspire to have in our companies. But culture is much more elementary than that. Culture is the process by which humans learn, share knowledge and information, share skills and capabilities, mimic each other in the process of surviving as a species. And that when in groups together, humans organically develop culture, whether it's a corporate setting, whether it's your community in your neighborhood, whatever it is, this is what we do. So Mark Pagel, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Reading, talks about, from a biological perspective, that we're wired for culture. And we're wired to learn. We're wired to learn from others. And that's done through empathy and trust. And so culture is this elemental aspect of human nature, or that is our cultural nature. And the challenge that I see it in the corporate environment is, by saying that we're going to try to develop this kind of culture or this kind of culture, that we actually undermine the organic development of culture in groups. And so I'll give you a sort of some background. Like, if you look at, we've hovered around 30% employee engagement levels for 60 plus years.
Long time.
70% of corporate change programs fail. 80% of mergers and acquisitions fail, often because of culture issues. Mm-hmm. Companies spend around $2,200 a year per person on culture programs, and quote unquote, and yet employees, like 68% of employees say they don't believe the cultural aspirations of their leaders. And 90% employees don't behave in ways that align with their leaders' culture goals. So it's, we're doing something wrong in terms of managing and motivating people. And I think my view, some
pretty harsh numbers to look at right off the bat.
Right off the bat. That's where I start the book, just some stats to say, okay, we have Houston, we have a problem. And so the standard approach today still, and this is really a target of mine in the book, trying to provide an alternative to, is we go in and we do a big culture survey and we get a result and says, we're a culture of this, and we score high on external focus or high on internal focus. And we have too much blue in the diagram and not enough red or whatever that sort of typology is. And then the goal of the consultant is to come in and to help them move from the current culture to the desired culture. And it's just an illusion from a scientific perspective. It's an illusion, in my view, that you can socially engineer a culture. And thus the data that I started with just now. The alternative is to create an open environment where you create the conditions where employees can do the things that humans are designed to do. And that is share information peer-to-peer, run experiments and get feedback, take small risks and not get punished if they fail, disagree with colleagues and leaders if they see an alternative point of view. These things are widely discouraged as it is now, typically. And so in a way, the sort of standard management approach, in my view, really almost shuts down culture from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about culture in this, and I want to get into all of the elements that you just described, that open culture and the framework for that. As we're talking about culture, though, something you said is interesting. It's natural. It is something that human beings absolutely do. And so one of the kind of fundamental realities is that any group of people who are interacting regularly in some fashion, they have a culture, if I'm right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in you know, duration over time makes a difference because that becomes traditions and stories and shared things that we think of as being, we identify with culture in terms of values and beliefs that develop over time, of course. But, and this is Pagel's point of view in The Wired for Culture, is that it's actually, culture also resides in our cognitive capability at the individual level, and it's the social collective level too. So, but yes, absolutely. And this is, and so there, this is what I tried to set out to do in the book, is identify companies that appeal to these natural element, natural things in the human condition. Like storytelling. Right. I mean, humans are, so at the beginning, I try to set out, talk about a few of the myths that management sort of relies on and then continuously creates problems for itself. But one is that, you know, we're rational creatures, and then we can be compelled to action through transactional, you know, means, goals, situations. But more than that, we're an emotional species. So storytelling is how people really find intrinsic motivation, whether it's their own goals, but also if you can work for an organization, it really helps to believe in the mission and to want their organization to be successful because you believe in the story. And so that's why I go through these five questions, and one of them is the why, which gets to the story part of it. But yeah, so so many different elements of it. I don't know really where to start. You know what I mean?
No, we'll get into the conversation here. We'll continue on. So that you know, that principle that you're talking about, that people have culture if over time they're working together and doing things together. One of the reasons I think that's important to note is that, you know, we'll hear sometimes, and you get to this in the fifth principle or the fifth question of open culture, when you're talking about where and flexibility, spaces, policies, and all these kinds of things. But the acknowledgement that people always have culture, that it's inherent in who we are and how we're working together, kind of undermines the argument that some folks, and we've heard leaders who will come out and make these proclamations of, I can't have XYZ of working this way of working because we have no culture. And it's, there isn't no culture, there is a culture, and you might not be investing in the principles of open culture, but they've got some kind of culture. And I think that's always important for us as leaders to recognize that there's always culture, and it's a matter of what conditions are we creating to allow what to grow.
That, and that's the challenge. And I think that this is the really the hard work that has to be done, or what are those conditions? And I try to talk about it in very plain terms, that these are not abstractions. Mm-hmm. There are certain tangible things you can put in place in a company that activate this. And so let's do that, right? As opposed to talking about abstract values. So, and this is one of the things that is so frustrating, is these standard culture surveys where we have the current culture and the desired future culture, the onus is put on employees. Okay, you need to change your values and beliefs and behaviors so we can do this better for customers and bring in more revenue for next quarter or whatever it may be. Well, what if you created conditions for their day-to-day working that allowed them to be better?
Yeah.
And stop talking about abstractions. And that's really what frustrates me about the standard culture talk in companies. And this is really the motivation behind it. It was almost like a missionary zeal. It's like, okay, you guys keep talking about culture. I've been around it my whole career. I'm tired of hearing about all these fly-by-night, quote-unquote, scientifically proven models that are going to get you the culture you want. And it's just, in my view, the wrong way to have that conversation.
Absolutely. It reminds me, and look, reading your book and hearing you talk reminds me of my first visit to the Bonsai Museum in Washington, D.C. It's National Bonsai Museum. It's in the middle of the National Arboretum. It was the first time I ever visited. The trees are amazing. They're gorgeous and beautiful. And I asked this gardener, caretaker, horticulturalist, whatever his title was, I said, you know, how do you make these trees so beautiful? And he was an older guy. He says, son, we don't make a tree do anything. And, you know, and I just, and it was one of those moments of profound wisdom years ago for me that it got to the heart of what, and my shorthand way of saying that now is, don't motivate, cultivate. When we're talking about leadership, is creating the conditions under which a growing thing grows. It does what it's going to do.
Can I steal that bonsai quote? That's beautiful. I like that. Thank you.
Don't motivate, cultivate. That's my shorthand way of saying of what he was telling me. But yeah, when it comes to leadership, and this is, so when you're talking about open culture, so A, I want to harken back to what you said about story. So many stories in this book, listeners, as you are thinking about the concepts here, and we're not going to have time to go into all of them. I'll have Drew pull out one or two for us as we get into it. But know that there are so many different ways of illustrating these principles, and so the book is chock full of those, and they're valuable. So when you're talking about open culture, then I just want to call out this definition before we dive into the framework. Your definition, open culture, is the collective capacity of an organization to innovate, learn, adapt, and outcompete its competitors in a long-term evolutionary game. I pulled that quote from the book, and I just thought that was powerful and goes along with what you've been saying. It's that collective capacity we have, and all those things that human beings in the right environment should be doing naturally. Learning, adapting, innovating, and learning comes from, you said, mentioned earlier, experimenting, taking risks. I learned something. Okay, I'm going to incorporate that now. I'm going to share that, and off we go. So we need to create the conditions for that to happen.
Yeah, and I think that the peer-to-peer element, and this is why the other, I mentioned it briefly in the book, is one of the motivations for me to call it open culture and the whole open culture movement is really open organization movement. It comes out of the work of Jim Whitehurst, who was the CEO of Red Hat Software, which was an open source software shop that was acquired by IBM in 2018 for $38 billion. So they did something right there. But they're a through and through open source company, and they have open cultural values, the way they organize everything. And what I try to do is bring the conversation from anthropology to that, say, well, there's a scientific real explanation for why open source companies that practice these things are so successful, because they really unlock the most potential out of their people. And that was really inspiring. So I want to make sure that in this conversation that I acknowledge Jim Whitehurst and his book, Open Organization, Igniting, and subtitles, Igniting Passion and Purpose at Work, really was like, was the tipping point for me to go ahead and finish this project. And so it's important, I think, also to acknowledge in this that, and my thinking has really in the last 6 months really continued to grow, particularly as embracing technology and AI. And that those companies that are innovating technologically, like open source shops do, the way Microsoft bought GitHub, which is an open source shop, IBM bought Red Hat, which is an open source shop, there's a growing realization that this is not just like for Silicon Valley startups and open source hippie kind of stuff in Silicon Valley. This is how innovation happens, is peer-to-peer contributions, disagreements, and accountability. And you borrow that metaphorically from open source development, which is adding, you know, code to a piece of code and getting contributions from multiple people in an open way, having that peer-to-peer checked by other developers. And then all that being trying to, in this spirit of meritocracy, well, where are the best ideas coming from? And let's go with those. And so there's, and then right now, and we can get to it in a little bit, but you know, I think AI and the openness of information through shared, not the language is still emerging really in a way, but you know, there are these open platforms for learning management in some companies where all employees have access to everything. And the idea is to include everybody to whom it's relevant, ideally that would be everybody, with the latest information about state of the customer environment, competitors, everything, so that people are have access, open access to information in such a way that they can act on it in a way in the best interest of the company, as opposed to, like, for example, Paul Zak, who's a organizational psychologist at Claremont Graduate School, writes prolifically in HBR and other places about trust. And in his studies, he found that 44% of the people in his big survey, employees, corporate employees, had no idea what the corporate strategy was.
Yeah.
So what are they doing every day?
How do you expect people to think strategically and act strategically if you don't give them the information, if they don't have access to it? And then people will come, and then leaders will often complain, like, my people aren't thinking, they're not thinking critically, they're not thinking strategically. Well, have you equipped them with the information they need to do that?
Yeah. And so, you know, trust is such a big part of it. In fact, Zak, he's a psychologist and not an anthropologist, but I give him credit for really nailing the evolutionary dimension. This is probably more in the weeds that we need to get, but it's probably worth saying, because I know in your on your website about the importance of just human-centered leadership and trust and all these things that we know now are so vital. But in the earliest days of the development of culture, it's interesting to think about it. It's kind of mind-blowing, actually. But, you know, trust is how trusting non-kin, that is people not related to you, was the beginning of community. And so, but it took that trust and that coordination of collective effort to, for human communities to start accomplishing things like big game hunting through collaboration or domestication of agriculture. So the very, so culture itself, community and culture together, just consider them one sentence, even though I guess, I mean, technically they're different, rely on trust as a definitional matter. And so when you're in an organizational setting and the trust index is super low,
going to be hard.
You're operating with ankle weights and at least one hand tied behind your back. You know what I mean?
And a heavy backpack. Well, let's start getting practical here. Our guest today is Drew Jones. The book is Open Culture Handbook, 5 Questions to Drive Engagement and Innovation. We've been talking about the nature of culture, the nature of community, the importance of trust in establishing and really creating the conditions in which people naturally do the things that people can do that are going to help your organization to be long-term competitive. So, Drew, let's get into these 5 questions in the Open Culture Framework, because these get super practical. They're all things we can start taking practical action on. So if you'll run us through the 5 at a treetop level, then we'll dive in and explore 1 or 2 of them in some more depth and hopefully get people interested and get this book and advance their own cultures.
Great. Thank you. So the reason I framed it in terms of questions is I've been involved with consulting assignments where we use these big standard culture assessments, and they can be anywhere between 60 and 150 questions. But for me, to be more tangible and material and practical, there's 5 questions that stood out to me in my research that are important. Is the why, what are we doing here? The what kind of work do you do every day? We can talk about all these other things, but what do you actually do? The how. How are decisions made and how are people organized? How autonomous or not are they? The who, that is really focused on leadership, and is there a growth mindset in the company and is that established by leadership or not? And then the where, this was really developed before the pandemic and before hybrid working, but the where, and part of the work that I do is the supporting corporate workplace transformation. So, you know, part of my work is in what's called workplace strategy. So the where of work has always been important to me as a material element of it. It's like, am I working at home by myself, or I'm in an office, I'm at a co-working space, I'm at a coffee shop. So that's constitutive of what you're doing, not just who you work with. So the material element of experience in the where is important too. So from what I know, one of the first culture models, if you call it that, where physical location was a part of it. Usually it's much more abstract. But anyway, those are the 5 questions, the why, what, how, who, and where of work. And that's the framework. And it's just a simple kind of couple of cases per chapter and a few.
You say simple, but then it gets pretty profound at the same time. So I want to start with, let's just do an example of that. So let's start with why. And your expanded definition or expanded question why is, what's the purpose of the organization? And I think that's a pretty vital question that most of us in our everyday leadership probably don't think about. And yet if we will think about it, it opens us to so many opportunities in terms of how we lead.
Yeah, and it ties also into, you know, what I refer to as anthropological leadership, and that's just the humility amongst leaders to listen. Ethnographically to employees. And so a great example of that I talk about in the book is IBM and their turnaround. And it's brought to my attention by Cynthia Montgomery. She's a professor of strategy at Harvard Business School, and she writes about this quite prolifically. But she has this, she deals with corporate teams developing or tweaking strategy. And she talks about what she calls the animating idea exercise. And it's this idea that a senior team should address, and then eventually in conjunction with the whole company, if the company's open to it, that's one of these challenges. And that's where these ideas are very difficult because most companies don't want to do them. But the animating idea exercise is to ask yourself two questions. Why does this company exist? Or no, what's the purpose of this company? No, what's the phrasing? It's been a while since I've read it straight out of her. Why does this company exist? One, and two, what would be different in the world if it didn't exist? And so Sal Palmisano, the CEO of IBM at the time, went through one of her workshops and then did at IBM what they called a values jam, where they posted those two questions on the intranet for the entire 300 plus thousand employees to respond to. And the response to the second question was, what would be different in the world if we didn't exist? And the answer was nothing. Mm-hmm. Because their competitors were Dell and Acer, Lenovo and Asus, and all these PCs and laptops that were getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper by the year. So here was this storied company with all this history. They were really in a race to the bottom on a price on, you know, physical objects. And it was through that exercise and the individual responses from employees that they should be more than that. They should be a more important company than that. And that was when they began to invest in what became known as cloud, enterprise cloud solutions, software to support infrastructure and grids. Clients went from being like just you and I buying laptops to powering the grid of nation states, oil platforms, like important infrastructure stuff. But that really turnaround didn't happen until they asked these two questions to their employees and started, well, what we have all these PhD scientists at IBM. Let's listen to them a little bit. So the change from hardware to software was through this animated. So for Cynthia Montgomery, an animating idea is a strategy told as a story. So it's not just the story. It's the course. It's the North Star of the company. And so now it's to bring science. I think their standard tagline is to bring science to prove the human condition. That's pretty powerful. And so a lot of these PhD scientists who could go into academics or go to work for IBM probably make a little bit more money with IBM, but you can do important work that impacts the world. So their recruitment improved. And so it's this virtuous spiral of creating, in a way, important research opportunities for their scientists to get involved with, to help the world, to bring these essential services to the world. And then when they bought GitHub, the open source shop, that was Microsoft. When they bought Red Hat, that signaled a commitment that they're continuing to accelerate that evolution as a forward-thinking company, IBM. So that's the on the why side. And then there's others. I mentioned Patagonia and its idealism around, their first stakeholder is the Earth, their second stakeholder is the Earth, and the third stakeholder is the Earth. And so it tends to attract both employees and customers who really share those values.
That strategy told through story element of the why, what's the purpose of your organization? And if you're the CEO, obviously you have some ownership of that. And if you're in senior leadership, but we can all invest in that. And so even if you're in an organization, as you're listening, and you're thinking, okay, that's pretty big. I'm not Patagonia, but how do I do that for my team? Every leader can do that. If we're working with a group of people, there is a story that we are about and a purpose that's bigger than us and a strategy that can be told through story. If we'll take the time and invest in that. And once people have that, then it allows us to get to some of those next questions, right? The what are employees experimenting, innovating, and growing in pursuit of that story, or the how question, which I wanted to ask you to take us a little bit deeper in. The how question, are teams self-organizing and accountable to one another? And this principle of human existence and human culture, if you will, is another one that is so profound and so hard for many people to wrap their head around from a leadership management perspective, because as you mentioned earlier, the myths of management, if we people will just do nothing or do the wrong thing or any if I don't really get on them. I mean, that's the myth in essence, right? And yet there is this self-organizing principle tendency, and that we can build in accountability. So I'd love for you to explore that with us. How do we help create the conditions in which our teams can self-organize, practice pure kind of horizontal accountability, if you will, and go from there?
Well, both in that section of the book, I talk about Morningstar Tomatoes, the tomato processing company, as well as W.L. Gore. And both of them have very similar processes that Morningstar calls it a colleague letter of understanding, or CLUE for short. And it's essentially a team agreement. For starters, they're extreme. I'm not advocating that companies necessarily go all in like Morningstar. They're 100% self-managing company. No job titles. Everything's team-based. It's just flat as can be. Company doesn't need to go that far. But some of the things they do are really impressive. And W.L. Gore does something quite similar. So a CLUE, a colleague letter of understanding, when you're hired, in fact, at Gore, they hire you because of your potential, and you can choose the project you start on. And you're committed to that lab or that project for a year. And similar at Morningstar. But when you start, you create a contract, essentially, that you write to the team, but you write it to an individual on the team. And it's a promise of what value you believe you can bring to that project, that team, for the coming year. And each, in the case of Morningstar, every other month, the person that was the recipient of a CLUE posts the new hire's progress against their own stated goals on the intranet for everybody to see. So nobody can hide from their performance. And at a certain point in the process, the team can say, this isn't working out, you're gone. No HR, none of that. So it's all peer-to-peer. And so that accountability, and W.L. Gore does something very similar, as does Simco and a lot of these companies I talk about, Hair Electronics, because the one-to-one boss direct report performance evaluation once a year, it's typically often how it goes, it is almost like become a ritual where you can kind of game it. If you do the right office politics, some people, an introvert, may not game the politics as well and may end up on the outside. But peer-to-peer accountability is continuous. It's the people you're working with on a daily basis, but it's also coupled with broad decision-making autonomy. So it's radical. It's self-organization coupled with what I call radical accountability. And so it's really applicable to things like this hybrid work and the work that I do in workplace strategy. Well, instead of a boss or the CEO determining all the hybrid policies, in my view, this should be team by team, and they should write this team agreement about how they're going to stay connected, whether virtually or in person, what that's going to mean in terms of getting a project done, honoring other people's needs to be either in the office or out of the office, and leaving these decisions up to the team level through these team agreements, but also making sure, as they say, it's Simco, for example, each year, each employee suggests to they do have a hierarchy, suggests to their senior manager what kind of raise they feel like they deserve. That is what their salary is going to be. But everybody knows the information. And so, if somebody gets a salary that's out of step with their contribution, everybody knows it and they hold them accountable. And so it's the phrase, and nobody wants to work with a shirker. You know, if you're not holding up to what you're promising, then it really stands out. Whereas a lot of companies that have a more command and control with an annual performance evaluation, they're all kind of people that, you know them, that sort of just coast and go through the motions and keep their head down and they're not really adding a ton of value, but they're not causing trouble, but they're still there. So in these self-organizing organizations, the idea is that, you know, we're going to give you a lot of freedom, but you better deliver or you're out. So there's a, and I talk about this in some of my graduate, in business school. And some of the students say, I'd hate to work there. I'd much rather be told what to do than to have my peers determine my fate. It's like, okay, well, there we go. This is what we're up against. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and it requires, you know, that freedom always requires responsibility too, right? They go hand in hand. If we're going to do that, if you're going to have that kind of radical level of self-organization and peer accountability, yeah, you got to bring some responsibility and initiative to it. And the principle there that I love, and I think, and part of what I look for in these kinds of conversations is, if you're in a role or in a position or you're building a company and you want to think through these things to get the book and go through that way, but if you're inside an organization and you're thinking about, gosh, I would love to have an open culture, I would love to look at, and I'm going to quote from the book here again, like, this is almost a criteria. Like, if you're, and Drew recommends starting with the everyday experience of your employees, how are they working, experimenting, innovating, and learning from those experiences and sharing that emerging knowledge? Well, what leader doesn't want that? I want that. I would, you know, like, if you want that, then these are some ways to start getting there. And you can use some of these principles that Drew's taking us through to get there. So whether it's strategy through story, whether it's starting to evaluate, not based on lack of disruption or on lack of headache, but evaluating and helping people to assess their own level of contribution, that's a whole different frame.
It is.
Lends to the self-organization and self-accountability in a totally different way.
It is. And another sort of structural way to bake that in, and many of the companies, talking about tangible examples, I'll make it quick. Whether it's 3M did it going back to the 70s, and Google did it, W.L. Gore does it, a lot of these companies do it. And it's some block of time per week, whether it's half a day or a day, whether it's called 20% time or 10% time or 15% time, with a structured program where employees are allowed part of a day to work with some colleagues on an innovative idea. It could be fixing an internal process. It could be brainstorming a product or a service for a customer or a new supply chain innovation, whatever it may be. And that being tied, the results of that being tied to some process where some management committee reviews it to see the viability, mm-hmm. and potentially shepherd it through to implementation or commercialization if it's a product or service related thing. So it gives people a sense that they can contribute beyond their day, you know, the grind, because face it, any job is going to have a certain percentage that's just repetitive and a grind.
That's grind to everything. Absolutely.
But having some aspect of a job where you're being asked to contribute something new, that's just essential to my understanding of culture, where you're contributing to the evolution and innovation of the organization by bringing something new, successful or success or failure, whatever it turns out to be. But it activates, and this is why, you know, research shows that companies that prioritize innovation have significant, and this is why I use those two words in the subtitle of the book, companies that have innovation programs, commit to innovation, and it's part of employees' regular deal, have significantly higher levels of innovation, of employee engagement. Because why? Because they're being able to be fully human. I mean, you know what I mean? As opposed to just
think and breathe and experiment and process. And yeah. And there's a principle there of like creating the time for and the expectation I'm going to be able to contribute beyond whatever my rote, the grind is. There's also, you're reminding me, I talked with Jason Fried, the co-founder of Basecamp.
Yeah. And
he said something that I thought was so important. He's like, if we want people thinking creatively, solving problems, solving different problems, solving better problems, any of that, you have to give people time for that. If we have filled people's time up wall to wall with meetings, rote, you know, that kind of approach, there is zero chance for creativity. That takes space, it takes breathing, it takes mentally being able to play and toy with an idea, which means not having to be engaged on something that's got to be done this second all the time.
Yeah, and it's one of the another myth that people are management myth that people are working for you 40 hours a week. You know what I mean? It studies show that people spend, in terms of really focused, productive work, I forget her name, Annie, woman who's head of people operations at Atlassian, has written about this. I think it's like between 3.5 and 4 hours a day is the average
right
prime mental commitment that
how
we much give.
Actually, yeah, actually having happen.
So the idea that there isn't 4 hours in a week, right, to get to give to employees for this experimentation, that's just old school thinking. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, this is one of the things that you know, hopefully, whether it's Morton Fried or Aaron Dingen, who wrote a great book called Brave New Work. I mean, there's a whole generation of thinking about this that's like, okay. And really the pandemic and remote work. And there's an article, you know, that I just read. I just want to shout it out. That to me is, it takes my point of view and just puts it on steroids in the best possible way, is an article by Michaela Zanini and David Weinberger in HBR last week. And it's about AI as an idea more so than just as a tool, and how the openness of information within organizations where people are given access to information, I'm not doing it justice, but I think my point is, you know, if I go back to the evolutionary framework of culture, Joseph Heinrich is a professor of evolutionary anthropology at Harvard, talks about culture, and I'll learn a lot of my understanding from him, but it's really about how we innovate. And he talks about whether it was early hunting spears, boats, domestication of agriculture, steam engines, merchant or big ships, transoceanic shipping, information revolution, and now AI, you know, all the way, if you look at the scope, the fruits of human culture, AI is just the latest one. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy for people to look at AI and be scared, but AI is exactly what humans do. Mm-hmm. It's leveraging that collective intelligence, yes, in an automated way. But companies that embrace that, I think, wholeheartedly, and he talks about some examples in that article, really are going to be the ones to, as he says in there, you know, management and historically has been framed around generalities taught in business school, generalizations. In this situation, you do this. In that situation, you do that, because I learned that in business school. But really, we're going to a world they say about particulars, where every person is a bundle of capabilities and has a certain amount of knowledge. And how can organizations leverage that knowledge and skills in a way that's relatively automated? It's by giving people access to information, and it cuts
to another.
Yeah. And so this notion of what's called organizational fleetness, like how many decisions have to be made internally to act on a demand, whether it's a customer demand or another employee demand, you get rid of those layers and just go from the point of knowledge to the solution. Yes, it's scary because it's going to reduce headcount in companies, but that's kind of the direction of human evolution, is leveraging information. And AI is really the next frontier, which I think is going to be as impactful as the Industrial Revolution.
And Drew, we are running out of time, but I'm so wanting to take that discussion and talk about large multinational global matrixed organizations that run businesses, which we're not going to have time for right now. But I have one more question for you. Before I ask that, can you please tell us, somebody wants to learn more about your work, connect with you, and you mentioned your company is rebranded. Want to get that in here. Where should we go?
Well, we're talking about the book and some of my more culture and leadership oriented work is just drewjones.co. That is drewjones.co. And The workplace strategy group that I run now is called abwlab.com. And that's where we help companies with hybrid solutions and workplace design and that sort of thing. But really for this kind of conversation, just drewjones.co. And LinkedIn, my LinkedIn profile is on both of those sites. So that probably should be enough coordinates to, if somebody's interested.
We'll get both of those in the show notes too. So absolutely. So Drew, my final question for you, obviously you give a lot of thought to this. You've been studying things for a long time in terms of workplace culture and culture in general. My final question for you is, when it comes to the types of things we've been talking about today, what have you changed your mind about and why?
Circles back to leadership. I think as much as for a long while, I was an advocate of really, I don't want to say the leaderless organization, but the view that flat organizations were really the default setting and that leadership could be redundant and unnecessary. But I don't believe that anymore. I believe that leadership is critically important in this open, working on a new project called Open Leadership. But it's situational leadership, letting leadership devolve to where the expertise is. But I think for groups to accomplish, so the idea of leadership not rested in an individual person, the old leaders are born, not made, but for effective group outcomes, there's always a leadership role in there. And it may be different from this situation to that, but I'm coming back around to the importance of leadership in a nuanced, different kind of way than maybe I used to see it. But yeah, so that's kind of my next research frontier and next book is like profiling these leaders who made me believe in leadership again.
I love it. Love it. All right. Well, given that the name of the show is Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, I love that that's been a mindset shift for you and how you're viewing that. And thank you for sharing that. So this whole learning aspect of things, are we growing? Are we learning? That means we're changing our mind about things. And so I appreciate you answering that question for us.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to talk and I will go get your book. Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you very much. And I appreciate you being on the show. So, wow, we have covered a lot of ground today, listeners. So if you're wondering, where do you get going? Where do you start here? So again, we're after the everyday experience of your team members, your employees, if you're leading the whole organization, how are they working, experimenting, innovating, learning from those experiences, sharing that emerging knowledge. Are we creating, as leaders, are we creating the conditions that allow people to do those very human activities and to self-organize, creating the conditions for the accountability to exist, all of those elements. Drew, if you give us one last, and I'm going to ask you to get down to a tweet here. If you give leaders who are wanting to embark on this journey and create open culture, one place to start, what's a first action you would recommend?
Get out from behind your desk and go listen. And make it even more tangible. Find two or three random employees that are a couple of levels below you and in the org and go talk to them about their career and life goals and see how that conversation goes and learn to listen. I think that that's elemental to this process of trusting people and realizing that there's more in my people than I give them credit for. And how can I capture their passion and what we're doing by trusting them? And I think the first step in that is rebuilding trust. And that's just by letting particularly younger people, you know, who are very cynical about corporate work. Now I'm going off again. But I think just scheduling a few one-on-ones or small group meetings and asking people about their career and life goals and, you know, are we the place where this is going to happen or not? But really more just letting that person elaborate on about themselves. And that's the anthropological process of just listening to others and having empathy for other people's experience. I guess that's really easier said than done, but that's what I would say.
And you'll learn.
Walk around and have a listen.
Have a listen. Our guest today is Drew Jones. The book is Open Culture Handbook, 5 Questions to Drive Engagement and Innovation. Drew, appreciate you being on the show and helping us learn how to organize and lead in a way that helps people naturally engage, innovate, hold themselves accountable, and so much more. Listeners, you've got some homework to do, if nothing else, to start with going out and have a listen.
Have a listen.
Be the leader you'd want your boss to be.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey, or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey, PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show.